This article appeared in the spring 2018 issue of UE World magazine. This is part two of Assumed Identities by Brando Skyhorse. As Indians, we had stories. My mother took an incomplete assortment of modern American Indian history, put it into a blender with her own backstory. Running Deer had run guns. That's how she got her name, at Pine Ridge during the Wounded Knee 73 occupation, by posing as a lawyer. She borrowed convicted murderer Leonard Peltier's narrative and upgraded Paul Skyhorse Johnson's actual crime of armed robbery, as if it needed upgrading, to double homicide of two FBI agents, retaliation for an FBI shootout at his house where his mother, Penny, was murdered on Mother's Day. I was the son not of just an Indian, but of a chief, for God's sakes. Of course, she had problem raising a chief's son. Like any spoiled, ungrateful child, I too was seduced by the white man's ways of transformers and video games. But in a vision she had with a medicine man, he saw an eagle fly over my head three times. "You will walk away from your people," she said earnestly. "Then you will return to the Indian people and help them. You will become who you are." From Indians, we didn't hear stories at all. Stepfather number two, an Aleut Indian born on St. George Island, Alaska, moved into our house when I was nine. He was an inveterate con man and equal opportunity thief. Robert stole a van from the Indian Center and money out of my birthday cards and piggy bank. I asked him what it was like to be an Indian. "I don't want to talk about that," he said. "No Indian wants to talk about that. That's how you know you've got a real Indian. Only Cherokees and white women want to talk about being Indian." Before stepfather number two even left, my mother had Paul Skyhorse Johnson queued up to move in with us when he was released from prison. Stepfather number two had a long criminal record, so she figured it was a safe bet that he'd flee or get caught for new crimes before long. She was right. He fled about a year before Paul was released. My mother must have figured it was a good time to tell me the truth. I was 12 or 13 when, after bugging my mother for months, I learned my biological Indian father, Paul Skyhorse Johnson, was, in fact, stepfather number three. There wasn't a singular aha moment, just a gradual acceptance of a different view, like a sunrise over a deep valley. It was a view deferred, though, when Paul moved in. He treated me as his biological son, and on nights my mother sent me out to retrieve him from a long, aching night at the bar, he told me I was an Indian, too. "We're White Mountain Apaches," he'd slur, "the only tribe that didn't sign a peace treaty with a white man." For my seventh-grade young author's project, he ghostwrote under my name an AIM manifesto called The Shame of America. He had no problem with these inconsistent positions, so my mother reasoned, why should I? I had problems, though. Why were we doing this? Why couldn't I just be a Mexican? Was it so awful? I felt I was lying every day to everyone I met. I was a con man, just like my stepfather's. No one understood, not my best friend, a Mexican who, ironically, was a musical Anglophile, whom I never heard speak Spanish, or my Asian girlfriend, who preferred my mother's fictional story of who we were. By denying my authentic self, I staggered into depression and came out holding a shitload of Depeche Mode, Cure, and Morrissey albums. Whatever empathetic gains my mother and I received from passing were emotional or psychological, insignificant or indiscernible to a teenager, but don't underestimate how much currency that has in a lower middle-class neighborhood to an adult. Indianness gratified and stoked my mother's extraordinary ego. That ego forgave her when her remedial Spanish stumbled out in Mexican restaurants in white parts of town. She spoke Spanish the way a white actress pronounced the words in a Hollywood Latin lover romance movie. My mother sounded as if she was pretending to be Mexican. Not a surprise, since that's what she did during work hours, too. For many years, my mother was a phone sex operator. Over several months, she had a client who asked to speak to a Latina. So my mother, who identified as Indian to her co-workers and callers, pretended the part in a true Victor Victoria deception. That is, my mother was a Latina, pretending to be an Indian, pretending to be a Latina. It had a different effect on me. Whatever gains one is bequeathed or accepts from passing as a member of another group comes with a separation or disconnection from one's original identity or self. No small gain occurs in passing without a more substantial accompanying loss. I gained a fake American Indian identity, but I lost my actual Mexican-American self. In college, I hid from both the Chicano and American Indian student unions, unable or maybe ashamed to connect with either group. "We heard you were kind of a radical," a young Indian girl said to me in an outreach phone call freshman year. I told her I didn't let my race define me, nor did I want to limit myself to just meeting people like me. How radical was I to stand up to an Indian Stanford student who worked her ass off to become part of a student population whose percentages are displayed in decimal points? I decided I wouldn't talk about race at all during and after college. During college was easy. In the early 1990s, nobody wanted to talk about race on my college campus. After college was tougher. I made this decision with a name like Brando Skyhorse and an appearance that's gotten me mistaken for Indian American, Sri Lankan, Afghan, and Turkish. It was not a very smart decision. I didn't want to lie about who I was anymore, but I'd learn people wouldn't accept a simple one, nor a two-word answer about who I was. Not talking about race isn't an option any person of color in this country has ever had, in particular if it's not clear what race you are. If it's clear what race you are, you just get skipped an interrogation level. It's always your responsibility to address your racist stereotypes, to ensure whoever's asking you that you aren't like what they heard. Be assured whatever they've heard is bad and you'll be asked to answer for it. Political correctness? Not in my reality. Political correctness never kept a racist from calling me a racist name. It never kept anyone at a bar from dehumanizing me because I'm not their nostalgic ideal of an American. It's never saved me from being reminded that I'm another. Political correctness isn't about depriving someone of their freedom. It's about giving someone the same inalienable rights that all Americans have. The right to not be hassled, insulted, or assaulted because someone thinks they're different. In other words, it's about protecting an American most cherished freedom, the right to be left alone. Drink more than two beers in a bar and you'll hear PC sound its bugle retreat. I don't mean to be a racist, but well, here's how it works for me. I order a beer, start a tab. The bartender notices the name on the card, Brando Skyhorse, making my name a question. It's been a question my entire life. I order a second beer. Bartender remembers my name, makes an innocuous comment. Buzzed, single white guy at the bar strikes up a conversation. If I'm lucky, I get a one-sentence lead-in about sports or politics. Most times, though, it's a straight shot to white-topia. The government fucked you over, just like it's fucked me and every hard-working white man I know that can't get a job. Mexicans, as it turned out, are dumb overbreeders who rape white women and their own bastard children, steal American jobs, yet sap our vital resources through their excessive laziness and pot smoking, sneaking like rats into our country, onto land that was theirs as recently as 1848. Whites can refight a war that ended less than 20 years later, fly the Confederate flag, and call it pride and heritage. Mexicans are part of a massive Aztlan conspiracy to reconquer the Southwest, refighting the Mexican-American War as law-breaking illegals that should be sent home. Then I spring the trap. "I'm Mexican," I say. "Well, I'm not talking about you, amigo. You're all right. I can talk to you." That's what it's all about, really, giving angry white men a safe space to be racist, where no one will call them racist. That exchange is what happens on a good night. If it's unclear to someone what race I am, I'm treated to a series of interrogative questions, each more invasive, until it's clear what stereotype best suits them. Every month or so, when I don't immediately explain my name and reveal my ethnic background, the POC version of name, rank, serial number, I have some variation of this conversation. Now, here's this month's latest variation. "So, where are you from?" he asks. "I live here in town." "No, I mean, where were you from before here?" "Vermont." "Vermont? No, where are your parents from?"
"Los Angeles."
"I mean before Los Angeles." "Well, they've always lived there." "Why are you being so difficult? What are you?" How I miss the gentle white touch of my long hair. Continuing to pass as an Indian after college led to more absurd situations. In New York, I was invited to a special publication dinner celebrating American Indian author Sherman Alexie. My well-intentioned boss sat me next to Sherman for no other apparent reason but, "Hey, let's sit the two Indians together." Sherman asked me what my tribe was. I told him what tribe my Indian father told me he was, White Mountain Apache. Then a little joke to deflect from the conversation I didn't want to have. My mother, I told him, wanted to name me Pacino. Later, he signed a copy of his book to me, Pacino Alexie. I stayed in the passing closet. With each small step I tried to take revealing the truth, there was always someone eager to help me back in. It was safer in there, and so much easier to relapse into a rehearsed story when everyone I met told me what I did wasn't even really lying. "Ah, take it easy, will ya? Besides, Mexicans are practically Indians anyway." Conciliation is one-sided. That is, a person who's passed from one group to another is comfortable with who they are. Reconciliation is the restoration of friendly relations with the community the passer originally left. I've been out about being Mexican for about 8 years. My Mexican unveiling and acceptance was a slow, gradual process. There wasn't a single moment, no simple update change on Facebook, no Aztlan eagle flying over my head 3 times. I still don't have a basic one or two-word answer when someone asks me what I am. It just became easier to say in a rehearsed voice, "I'm a Mexican who has an American Indian last name." Sometimes that leads to more questions. Should the Washington Redskins change their name? Sure, but aha! How can you tell them to change their name when you're guilty of the same cultural appropriation as Redskins owner Dan Snyder? What would you say to Donald Trump? "Adios, muchacho." But aha! How can you stand up for your people when you're hiding behind an American Indian creation? Why not just change back to Ulloa? Anyone who's been abandoned by their father knows better than to ask me this. A couple of years ago in Brooklyn, in a bar in gentrifying Bushwick, I ran into a group of young 20-something white women dressed in faux Indian headdress and face paint on Thanksgiving. A friend of mine from Atlanta was appalled and said, "You'd never see that in Georgia." I approached the woman with the tallest feathers and asked, "What tribe are you?" She replied, "Cherokee." "Oh, well, what part of the country are you from?" "This is an art project," she said. A friend of hers chipped in, "Why are you being so aggressive about this?" I told them, "You're in a fake headdress and fake paint on Thanksgiving. Do you wear blackface on Martin Luther King Day?" Pay no attention, of course, to the Mexican behind the Indian name. I had a Facebook conversation with an American Indian PhD candidate at University of Chicago who friended me after my memoir was published. Our discussion stemmed from Dartmouth's decision to appoint a self-described American Indian from the Delaware tribe to head its Native American program. She wasn't Indian. Her grandfather descended from Irish immigrants. The resultant attention led to her removal. What did I think about this? I thought about a round-trip plane ticket to Dartmouth wrapped in aluminum foil. I thought about flight, about entering a plane one person and then that flight becoming something else, emerging on a fresh New Hampshire snow as a confident Mexican. Even at the risk of losing his scholarship because he was the wrong kind of person of color. And I thought about a silly symphony cartoon I saw many times as a child, The Flying Mouse. In it, a mouse saves a butterfly about to be eaten by a spider. The butterfly transforms into a spectacular Aryan blue fairy who grants the mouse a wish. "I want to fly," he said. "A mouse was never meant to fly," she replies, but gives him a large pair of bat wings. The mouse flies over his brothers and mother who, spotting his bat wing silhouette on the ground, race to their home inside a pumpkin. Running into a dark, sinister wood, the mouse meets a large bat. "Hello there, brother," the bat says and laughs. The black bat has large, bright, jaundiced eyes, stands twice the mouse's size, and flaps his wings like a vampire cape. "I'm not your brother," he says, afraid. "I'm a mouse." "No mouse can fly," the bat says, and snaps one of his mouse bat wings in the mouse's face. "So if you ain't a bat," and here the bat laughs at the mouse, "you're nothing." The mouse cries, his lesson learned, and the fairy disappears his wings. "Be yourself," she says, "and life will smile on you." But the fat bat and the fairy were wrong. The mouse wasn't a nothing. His dream to fly was about him being himself. Native appropriation is my mother's legacy to me, and something I try to make sense of every day. You could say she was just another thief on a very long list of people who take without asking, appropriate without acknowledgement, and act as if good intentions supersede bad behavior. Or you could say that her dream was to be herself. I know she wanted to be Native. And when I confirmed her Mexican identity with friends and one of my stepfathers, they almost couldn't or wouldn't accept that she wasn't. My mother thought belief trumped truth. She lived her life with a pair of bat wings only she could see. I'm sure she'd say it was the only honest way to live. Many years after my mother's death, I visited my first reservation, arranged by a nun I met during a U-Cross Foundation writer's residency in Wyoming. I had Indian tacos on the Crow Reservation in Montana, and then bought ceremonial sweetgrass at the Little Bighorn Battlefield Visitor Center gift store. There were many books about Indian history and a video outlining Custer's last stand looped on a loud television. Every few minutes, reenactment screams from Indian braves filled the store. Was this my mother's version of heaven? Across the road from a store was an Indian memorial fire pit, used by Indian elders for religious ceremonies. My mother would have wanted me to burn the sweetgrass there. Instead, I took it back to my writer's residency and that night threw it into an open fire pit. Under a bright, starry, black Wyoming sea of sky, I breathed in the smell of burning sweetgrass and prayed to her idea of the Great Spirit. As a Mexican boy from Echo Park with an Indian name, I wanted to see my mother safely home. William Faulkner wrote, "I am telling the same story over and over, which is myself and the world. Passing is both myself and my world. This, at last, makes sense to me." Does it to you? This article was written by Brando Skyhorse, the author of Take This Man, a Memoir, and the novel The Madonnas of Echo Park. And this is a service provided by the Unitarian Universalist Association, UU World, and Equal Access. This article was read by Don Heimel of DPH Vocalese, a member of First UU Church of San Antonio, Texas.